Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Clean Energy and Environmental Sustainability Initiative. Speaking will be Melanie Kenderdine, Executive Director of the MIT Energy Initiative. We begin with an introduction by Dr. Kenneth Luchin, Dean of BU's College of Engineering.
You all know virtually every major academic institution in the nation has identified initiatives to address the world's challenges to meet its increased energy needs while sustaining a safe environment and in an economically sustainable fashion as well. And, of course, Boston University is no different. On a broader and ambitious scope, about 1.5 years ago, Boston University began a university-wide clean energy and environmental sustainability initiative. This joint initiative is between engineering, arts and sciences, and the School of Management, has a mission of designing and providing powerful educational and research experiences at the interface of technology, public policy, economic and environmental sustainability, and all from a systems perspective. Faculty in this initiative are leading cross-disciplinary and world-class research groups in areas such as smart grid, the hydrogen economy, green manufacturing, smart lighting, and socioeconomic challenges of energy adoption. This effort is also synergistic with Boston University's Institutional Sustainability Initiative, dedicated to making this institution as green as possible and as environmentally friendly as possible. And, of course, we have the BU Energy Club, now up to over 600 students. The College of Engineering at a local level has a concentration program in energy technologies and environmental engineering, accessible from any major, and that program has nearly maxed out in its second year. Now, through generous funds provided by the President Brown's office, we've created this lecture series, a series that will be and has been bringing in some of society's leaders that address technology, economic, environmental, and policy issues associated with the energy and climate. These speakers derive from government, academia, industry, and national laboratories. And all of these speakers play a major role at the world's leading technological institutes and government institutions to impact energy. Today's speaker is Melanie Kenderdine, the Executive Director of the MIT Energy Initiative. Melanie joined the MIT Energy Initiative in March of 2007. This initiative focuses on innovative technologies and underlying policy analysis to help improve how we produce, distribute, and consume conventional energy as well as the creation of transformational technologies to develop alternative energy sources and to create global systems to meet energy and environmental challenges. Melanie Kenderdine is a member of a three-person leadership team of this initiative, responsible for its implementation and the development of long-range strategies for its activities, management, and growth. Prior to joining MIT, she was vice president of the Gas Technology Institute for Washington Operations, where she was involved in major initiatives to increase domestic natural gas supply, enhance energy efficiency and security, and promote the research needs of the natural gas industry. From 1993 to 2001, Melanie Kenderdine served in several key posts at the U.S. Department of Energy, including the Director of the Office of Policy and Senior Advisor to the Secretary. Melanie has testified before Congress on many occasions, has served on numerous energy task force, and is frequent speaker at international energy conferences, including the World Petroleum Congress, IEA's International Energy Experts Conference in Abu Dhabi, and the Turkish War College in Istanbul. The talk today is entitled Enabling a Clean Energy Future. Please welcome Melanie Kenderdine.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you all for coming here today. A short time ago, the world's leaders met in Copenhagen to try and reach some kind of consensus on a path forward on climate change mitigation. Many thought this meeting was a disappointment, and some thought it was an outright failure. But some people thought it was actually a breakthrough of sorts because it put an end to the unrealistic structure of the Kyoto Protocol. And hopefully we will be moving on to more meaningful and achievable outcomes through a range of bilateral and multilateral options. I'm going to throw out a few of those for you today. President Obama's efforts in Denmark were instrumental in facilitating these changes, the importance of which his activities, I think the importance of those were underappreciated. In his State of the Union speech earlier this month, the President again highlighted climate change, making clean energy a hallmark of his administration. there are abundant reasons for a radical course correction in the nation's energy policies and investments. Historically high oil imports, extremely volatile energy prices, aging infrastructure, growing energy demand, and a range of environmental issues all make the view from 10,000 feet pretty discouraging. History also shows us that to date, we have been unable to muster the collective will to develop and implement a national policy that transforms how we produce, distribute, and consume energy. Indeed, a combination of short-term palliatives and fuzzy long-term aspirations has contributed to, as my friend Dan Juergen describes it, the slow-motion energy train wreck we are witnessing today. Of all our energy challenges, none is more critical or intractable than climate change, the solutions to which are fundamentally different than all other energy problems. To address it and mitigate it, we seek to alter natural systems on a global scale. That's as opposed to social, economic, or political systems for most energy issues, where we only are looking at national or regional scopes. The reach of this problem and its lack of respect for national boundaries requires new and fundamentally different approaches to international as well as domestic problem solving. It also requires a collective commitment to developing and deploying a suite of clean energy technologies at a scale the likes of which we have never seen. This rather bleak description is intended to serve as a wake-up call to a new reality. The energy marketplace of the 1970s, on which we have based much of our energy policy and around which we have built a policy apparatus, an entrenched bureaucracy, and an army of advocates, this marketplace no longer exists. We urgently need a new roadmap to address the daunting energy challenges of the 21st century, the most important of which is climate change. Question is, are we up to the job? First, a brief climate overview. Much of what I'm going to discuss right now in this section is likely familiar to most of you in the room, but I think a recap is helpful for context. First, let's look at global CO2 emissions for key countries and regions of the world. Currently, just six countries, the U.S., Japan, Russia, India, Germany, and China, are responsible for 60% of the world's CO2 emissions. By 2030, the world will see a 30% increase in emissions. 68% of that increase will come from China, the U.S., India, and the Middle East. 49% of it will come from China alone. Even stabilization at 450 parts per million by mid-century, and we are already at around 385, will raise global temperatures by at least 2 degrees. Global warming is uneven, with some parts of the world warming faster than others. The areas highlighted here are likely to have the most pronounced temperature increases. One region, the Arctic, has already warmed considerably, with temperatures in some areas rising as much as 7 degrees over the last 20 years, and that's Celsius. Deserts will grow, accompanied by significant changes in water availability. According to the UN, this will put at risk the health and well-being of 1.2 billion people in more than 100 countries. Areas at severe risk for increased aridity include Central Australia, the Middle East, Northwest China, Northern Africa, most of the Mediterranean, the Western U.S., and Southern Africa. Water availability in Southern Europe is expected to decline by 20% over this period. Declines in parts of Africa will be even more dramatic, according to the UN, putting 250 million people at risk of water shortages. Climate change is also contributing to larger and more frequent forest and range fires, which, by burning off vegetation, further exacerbate warming. These impacts have already been felt. In Australia and the U.S., the two fires you see here, they saw much larger fires in 2009. In the last 2 decades, fires in the western U.S. have burned 6 times more acreage than in the prior 20-year period. Many of the world's small glaciers have already melted, having pronounced impacts on the Andes and the Himalayas. In the Hindu Kush, high levels of water discharge from melting glaciers typically occur between April and September. This is now occurring between April and May. The disappearance of mountain glaciers will represent a serious water challenge to 1/6 of the world's population. It also creates major energy problems as well, particularly in South America, which gets a disproportionate share of its electricity from glacier-fed hydropower, with some countries approaching 100%. There will be increased precipitation in some regions, including North Central Asia, Northern Europe, Central Eastern Africa, Eastern South America, and the Eastern U.S. The likelihood of increased precipitation in these regions is in doubt, however, if temperatures rise above 2 to 3 degrees Celsius. There will be increases in the severity of weather-related events as well. The increased weather events are something like we saw in Washington, D.C. The last week, which is where I live. I actually live in Washington, D.C. I commute up here every week, and there's 6 feet of snow on either side of my driveway. There's been a lot of talk, no global warming, because there's been a lot of snow in the east. It's just an increased weather severity event. The Stern Report, 2004 Stern Report on Climate Change, says that a 5 to 10% increase in hurricane speeds will, for example, double annual damage costs in the U.S., affecting insurance premiums, state and federal disaster funding, etc. Directly related to increased severity of weather events is flooding. There will be increased flooding, in this instance, flooding that is not related to rising sea levels, but from severe weather events, particularly hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, etc. This also includes flooding from melting glaciers, where there was initially expected to be an increased flood risk before a drop-off in overall water supply. Flooding from weather-related events could be especially severe along the U.S. Gulf Coast and Asian coastal regions. I already went through the wheat. The wheat that I showed you earlier is located in the countries that are the largest wheat producers. There is expected to be a major drop-off in food and grain supplies because of climate change. The cereal-to-stocks ratio is already at its lowest point in 30 years, and in the developing world, if China and India are removed from the equation, food production has already declined. Wheat is quite sensitive to temperature increases. Major production declines are anticipated, particularly in South Asia. Corn is the largest, went through corn too, also the largest grain crop in the world. The most significant production declines are expected in southern Africa, where there are indications that the region, whose poor rely heavily on maize for their calories, could experience as much as a 30% decline. South Asian rice production is also particularly sensitive to temperature. According to researchers at Stanford, rice in this region has a 75% chance of significant declines over the next 2 decades. We can expect significant sea ice decline. According to the director of the NSF's Office of Polar Programs, Arctic Ocean sea ice has shrunk to the smallest area ever recorded by satellites. Some scientists have forecast that by 2040, the Arctic Ocean in summer will be totally ice-free. The melting of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets translates into a sea level rise. One of the most vulnerable countries will be Bangladesh, where a 1.5-meter rise would affect 22,000 square kilometers and 17 million people. Other affected regions include parts of northern Europe, the Caribbean, East and Southeast Asia, parts of Africa, and island nations, where increased salinity from these sea level rises will threaten their water supplies, and coastal protections and barrier reefs will be lost. Finally, and I know this cartoon looks a little silly, but the issues raised by the melting of the Arctic ice sheet are anything but, especially for those nations with Arctic coasts. You may have noticed in the paper a couple of months ago that a ship, here comes the silly part, that a ship made it from Siberia to Western Europe over the top without encountering any ice. The captain said he was astounded. There are significant oil and gas resources in the Arctic, which is currently an unregulated production province. Russia is already claiming that some of its island chains are internal waters as opposed to territorial waters, a claim not surprisingly disputed by the U.S. Several countries are engaged right now in the Arctic in subsurface seafloor mapping because subsurface extensions of the continents are a key consideration in expanding claims to drilling rights. This poses a significant risk for geopolitical conflict in the region, and it needs a serious review by the requisite international bodies. That's why I call it the Armageddon slide. This slide illustrates some key indicators that help define the geopolitics of climate change. The dark green is a percent of world population. The light green is percent world GDP. The light blue percent world CO2 emissions. And the dark blue is percent cumulative emissions. I think that the cumulative emissions are from 1900. I need to go back and check, but I think that that's what they calculated here. Of note on this slide, The U.S. here has a lower percentage of CO2 emissions, we're over there on the left, relative to its GDP, but much higher emissions relative to its population. It's not surprising that the Obama administration's commitment going into Copenhagen was to set up a national emissions target. China, on the other hand, has very high emissions relative to its GDP. Quite understandably, it wants to sustain its economic growth, so its commitment in Copenhagen was to lower its carbon intensity, that is, its CO2 emissions per unit of GDP. While this won't likely lower overall emissions, it could lower their trajectory. And finally, India, there a little bit to the right, proxy for other developing countries, wants cumulative emissions, where the U.S. and the EU hold a commanding lead. Those are the two large blue bars over on the left. India wants those to be taken into consideration. It would like the developed world to compensate the developing nations for the cost of their emissions reduction programs, commensurate with the cost of the cumulative emissions of the largest offenders. Going forward from Copenhagen, these common but differentiated commitments could form the basis for the bilateral and multilateral agreements I referenced earlier. Very quickly, I want to illustrate for you the magnitude of the emissions reductions required to meet a 90% CO2 reductions target by 2050. The reduction targets vary in pieces of legislation. I think Waxman-Markey is 83%. Some are 90%. 90% is a simpler number here. Under business as usual, we will emit about 80 billion tons of CO2 in 2050. A 90% reduction from that level will mean a CO2 budget for the entire world of around 8 billion tons. I just want people to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about these targets. In 2050, the world population is supposed to approach 9 billion people. This equates to a CO2 budget of around 1 ton per person. This next slide illustrates the implications of that CO2 budget, depicting current CO2 emissions per capita in various countries of the world. On the far left is the U.S. at 19 tons per person. Next to it is India, right next to it, and India is around 1 ton per person. The challenge for the U.S. will be to meet overall reduction targets and maintain its lifestyle on a per capita CO2 emissions budget that is the equivalent of India's today. Again, climate change imperatives suggest that we need to totally transform global energy systems in 2050, and the lead times are quite long for doing so. We also need to get from here to there without causing major economic dislocation, impeding economic growth, or increasing energy security disputes. This transformation is fundamentally about lowering the costs of low-carbon alternatives. This slide shows levelized costs of electricity in cents per kilowatt hour, and it depicts just how far we have to go in order to meet that goal. The first are the prices of baseload power, which is defined by the National Academy as capacity factors above 75%. As you can see here, coal is coming up first. That's coal without carbon sequestration, and the bar on the back is the cost of coal with carbon sequestration. What you can see here is that coal is inexpensive without CCS, but in the worst case, CCS can actually triple the price of coal. Next is natural gas. Natural gas without CCS is the cheapest baseload power we have right now. The natural gas with CCS is more expensive, about twice the cost of gas without carbon sequestration, but still cheaper than coal with CCS. Nuclear, geothermal, and biopower are more expensive than gas or coal without CCS, but all are competitive with coal with CCS. None of them beat gas at the low end. It's worth noting here that at the low end of the nuclear price, you see here nuclear is 6 to 13 cents. At the low end of the nuclear price, that includes subsidies and loan guarantees. Let's move to the intermittents here. Intermittents are defined as having a capacity factor of 25 to 45%. As you can see here, the top two bars, first is concentrated solar power, big range, 8 to 20 cents. But it is competitive. It's quite expensive relative to all the baseload options, with the exception of unsubsidized nuclear and coal with CCS. Solar PV is more expensive still, with prices exceeding those of the lowest cost gas generation by as much as 5 to 7 times. Onshore wind, those are the purple bars down at the bottom, onshore wind is competitive with natural gas with and without CCS, but it still has issues of intermittency, and these prices do not include the cost of firming power that you would need to compensate for that intermittency. Offshore wind can be competitive in some instances with coal and gas, but the price range is substantial, and again, intermittency is still an issue. The cost and intermittency features of the alternative suggest that most of these are longer-range options for CO2 mitigation. Let's briefly turn to options for coal. China surpassed the U.S. in CO2 emissions 2 years ago. This big, huge piece of the pie here down at the bottom is China. It has almost 6 billion tons in 2010. The U.S. is next largest, second largest, at around 2.2 billion tons. 43% of the global emissions are from coal. China's emissions from coal in 2010 will be around 45% of the global total. It will exceed those of OECD Europe and Asia, the U.S., and the rest of the world combined, excluding only Russia, Africa, and India. And those are all relatively small, not India's, but the other two. Three countries, China, the U.S., and India, will account for 68% of global coal CO2 emissions in 2010. If I were looking for a multilateral arrangement in order to have the most effective and high impact on reducing emissions, it would be on coal with China, the U.S., and India. By 2030, emissions from power generation in the U.S. will exceed those from transportation. Right now, they're slightly smaller, slightly less. But in 2030, they will exceed them, and 81% of our CO2 emissions from power generation are from coal. You've undoubtedly heard a lot about carbon capture and sequestration, or CCS. The conventional wisdom is that CCS is the key enabling technology for widespread use of coal for decades into the future. I wanted to provide a little ground truth about CCS. First, CCS is not a near-term option. Few serious people think that it will be ready for large-scale commercial deployment for at least 15 years, and market diffusion will take longer still. Second, much of the research that the federal government has supported to date has focused on new plants, when in fact EIA says that 92% of our coal capacity in 2030 is actually in existence today. That suggests that the focus of federal CCS research should be largely on existing plants. Retrofitting these plants, however, is an expensive proposition. The U.S. coal fleet has a capacity of around 332 gigawatts, with an average age of 35 years. The carbon avoidance costs for retrofitting a subcritical plant with post-combustion capture are $74 per ton. For supercritical plants, it's $52 a ton. That's why the price of coal electricity triples that I showed you in the previous slide is because it is so expensive. Capture technologies reduce relative plant efficiency between 24 and 26%. This would make many older, less efficient plants and take them below 20% overall efficiency. That's a very unattractive proposition for the environment and for CO2 emissions. This means that only 184 gigawatts, or around 55% of capacity, is theoretically capable of being retrofit for CCS. Plants, however, need to have desulfurization scrubbers for post-combustion capture to work well, and only 50% of U.S. coal plants have such units. Furthermore, a CCS unit takes up 6 acres, and many plants are urban plants. Post-combustion capture also uses twice as much water as a plant without CCS, and plants have to have carbon offtake capacity. You need a suitable aquifer in order to store and sequester the carbon, and if you're not located near one, it's very problematic. This means that U.S. coal plant capacity capable of being retrofit for CCS is well below 50%, and again, it's a long-range option, not a short-range option. Let's move to options for early action. According to the 2004 Stern report I mentioned earlier, to stabilize CO2 emissions at 450 parts per million by 2050, global emissions need to peak in 10 years. At 550 ppm, they need to peak in 20. 6 years later, after the Stern report, little has happened. The situation is even more urgent, and our near-term options are becoming increasingly limited. A little bit more on urgency. Since these warnings in 2004, we have increased our understanding of global systems and have more sophisticated modeling of changes in atmospheric and ocean currents, feedback loops, etc. This has, however, set off new alarms. This slide here depicts the so-called climate change roulette wheel developed by Professor Prin and others at MIT. The wheel was a result of a study issued last year, which itself was an update of an earlier study released in 2003. The roulette wheel is a cartoon showing the probability of temperature rises by 2100 with and without policy interventions. Here on the left is without policy intervention, and you can see the yellow and the kind of orange slices of that pie are 4 to 6 degrees Celsius, and those take up the most space on the pie. The bad news is that new projections that serve as the foundation for the roulette wheel indicate that under business as usual, with no policy interventions, there is a median probability of surface warming of 5.2 degrees Celsius by 2100, with a 90% probability of 3.5 to 7.4 degrees. Most of all of those changes took place, those impacts occurred at an increase of 2 to 4 degrees Celsius. This compares to a median projected increase in the 2003 study of just 2.4 degrees. The good news is that with relatively modest early interventions, they can have a major impact on temperature increases, keeping them within 2 to 3 degree range you see here on the right. In fact, I think we should be worrying a lot less about 2050 or 2030 and a lot more about 2020, because not all greenhouse gas emissions are created equal. Today's CO2 emissions will determine tomorrow's temperature trajectories. Further, the long lifespan of energy infrastructure means that the investments we make today will be with us for the next 40 to 50 years. Once we set a course to meet energy demand at scale, we might not be able to turn back. What, then, are some of the near-term options for avoiding a collision? Efficiency is the obvious first choice. While it's not one of the elephants in the room, it often receives more lip service than serious policy support. This is unfortunate because we can heavily leverage all of our energy supplies with efficiency. Let's move from efficiency to the first elephant in the room, which is nuclear energy, a no-carbon source of baseload power. I believe that the widespread public opposition in the U.S. will limit this as a near-term option for us. This is not the case, however, with the rest of the world, where there are currently 44 nuclear power plants under construction. Not surprisingly, the Chinese are leading the pack with 11, followed by the Russians and the Indians. Opposition to this option in the U.S. will make it relatively more expensive for us to enter into binding agreements with India and China, for example, which I've been advocating, because those countries are actually accruing credits or will accrue credits and carbon benefits by deploying nuclear plants, and we won't. Natural gas is the other elephant in the room that gets no respect. It's not a no-carbon fuel, but it's a low-carbon fuel, emitting less than half the CO2 of a typical pulverized coal plant. Across the bottom here of this graph is 100 gigawatts. Recall, we generate about 332 gigawatts of our electricity from coal, so this is about a third of our capacity. As you move up the graph, you replace more coal, need more gas, and reduce more CO2 emissions. With an incremental 5 trillion cubic feet of gas, and we consume about 22 TCF per year in the U.S., we could repower 30% of our coal capacity and reduce total overall U.S. CO2 emissions by 9% in 2020. To put this in perspective, the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade bill and President Obama's position at Copenhagen have a CO2 reduction target of 17% by 2020. You could meet over half of this target simply by repowering 30% of our coal-fired power generation capacity with natural gas. There's been a lot of hysteria about the size of the domestic gas resource base in recent years, with a lot of people saying we're running out of natural gas. U.S. gas markets, however, have been radically changed by the deployment of new technologies that enable us to produce gas from shale rock and other unconventional sources. In 2000, we were drilling very few shale wells. 8 years later, we had drilled over 3,700, or an increase of over 1,800%. Credible estimates place domestic gas supplies at a couple hundred years of supply at current rates of consumption. New technologies have opened up an enormous domestic natural gas resource base, and there is ample near-term opportunity for reducing CO2 emissions by repowering old coal plants with new natural gas combined cycles. Obviously, this is not a view shared by the coal industry. Let me now switch gears to the role of the federal government in energy and climate policy. Before discussing some of the things we should be doing, I wanted to highlight a few things we should not, and tell you a few cautionary tales. Climate change makes it more critical than ever that we get energy policy and investments right. My first admonition is about the technology du jour syndrome, illustrated by our fairly brief and expensive love affair with hydrogen. The headlines tell the story. In 2003, President Bush announced the hydrogen-focused Freedom Fuel Initiative. Combined with the Freedom Car Initiative, he proposed $1.7 billion to develop hydrogen fuel cells, a hydrogen infrastructure, and advanced hydrogen automotive technologies. In 2004, the National Academy released a report on hydrogen suggesting a slightly less exuberant approach. They weren't opposed to hydrogen. We should be looking at it, but perhaps not at the $1.7 billion range. Many serious technologists were skeptical, citing energy density and infrastructure issues, as well as the fact that hydrogen, like electricity, is not a primary fuel source. Undeterred, Governor Schwarzenegger proposed a hydrogen highways plan for California that same year. The federal government poured more money into the plan in 2004. Not to be outdone by California, Governor Jeb Bush proposed a hydrogen highway plan for Florida in 2005. By 2008, California's hydrogen highway was teetering on collapse and declared to be on life support in 2009. President Obama's first budget proposal in 2009 slashed funds for hydrogen to zero. Another cautionary tale is about the unintended consequences and the danger of policymaking by mandates, which are seldom supported by serious analysis and rarely provide a satisfactory answer to the question, what happens if the mandate is not met? The 2005 energy bill included an ethanol standard, mandating the use of 8 billion gallons of ethanol as a transportation fuel. In 2006, many governors, Governor Schwarzenegger then, got on the ethanol bandwagon. Schwarzenegger built ethanol fueling stations across California. In December of 2007, the Congress expanded the renewable fuel standard, requiring 9 billion gallons of ethanol in 2008 and 36 in 2022. Then the problems really began. 2008, governors were blaming the rising grain and food prices on the ethanol mandate. In 2008, the food industry sought a waiver from the mandate. By the summer of 2008, the New York Times wrote about an uprising against the mandate. And the coup de grace in 2009, the ethanol industry itself, in the face of plummeting oil prices and gasoline prices, ask for relief from the ethanol mandate. Next is a warning about the herd mentality in energy. You see it everywhere. In 2003, Fed Chairman and renowned gas expert Alan Greenspan told Congress that North America was running out of natural gas. Later that same year, Exxon and Qatar signed an agreement to develop liquefied natural gas, with the U.S. as the primary export target. In 2004, President Bush and the campaign signaled his support for increasing LNG import capacity in the U.S. and implemented policies to expedite this option. In 2005, Exxon CEO Lee Raymond once again told Reuters that North American gas production had peaked. On that very same day, a large shale gas play was discovered in Texas, and discovered is in quotes here because that was the Barnett Shale, and it was starting to produce. We knew the gas was there, and it was starting to produce more prolifically. By 2008, shale gas production in the U.S. had taken off. By 2009, domestic gas production was killing off the need for LNG imports. New import terminals in the U.S. were sitting half empty. And this is really almost funny. In late 2009, Exxon purchased XTO, a major domestic producer in unconventional gas, making a major bet on the future of North American gas. They're losing a lot of money on LNG, by the way. This final story is so old that I couldn't find any headlines on the internet, so I had to make them up. I confess they're kind of dumb, okay? But nevertheless, my poor substitutes tell an important story about the extremely long-term impacts policies can have on both fuel choices and on energy infrastructure. Prior to the Arab oil embargo in 1973 and 74, a significant percentage of our power was generated with oil. Natural gas generation was gaining market share. After the embargo, the Congress engaged in a lengthy debate about the wisdom of oil and gas for power generation. Not surprisingly, this debate had a chilling effect on any new gas plant construction. And starting in 1975, virtually all new power plants were coal-fired or nuclear. That was until Three Mile Island in 1979, of course. In 1978, Congress actually outlawed the use of gas in power generation, a law commonly known as the Fuel Use Act. The oil embargo, plus the Fuel Use Act, plus TMI, spurred a wave of coal plant construction in the United States. At the same time, President Carter partially deregulated the gas industry, and new technologies spurred gas production. In 1987, Congress repealed the Fuel Use Act. This, plus new exploration and production technologies and advances in gas turbines, spurred a wave of gas plant construction. Between 1975 and 1987, 20% of all today's coal units went online. Since 1987, there have been 516 gas plants built compared to 15 coal plants. These numbers tell the real story about where the marketplace wants to put its money when it doesn't have a statute that forces the use of coal. Importantly, in 2007, 32 years after the passage of the Fuel Use Act, almost 30% of all CO2 emissions from power generation in the U.S. come from coal plants built between, guess when, 1975 and 1987. Again, this has a huge impact on both our infrastructure that we are living with today, these are very long-lived infrastructures, as well as on our fuel mix that we're using. I've spent some time discussing the what of energy and climate policy. I would now like to focus briefly on the how. What are the best ways and means to effectively align federal policies, regulations, and investments against the strategic objective of a clean, low-carbon energy future? President Obama has taken some important first steps. He has a tremendous leadership team at DOE with extraordinary scientific expertise and a demonstrated focus on alternative energy. In the White House, he has appointed the first ever assistant to the President for Energy and Climate Change, as well as a science advisor deeply experienced in energy technology and policy. Charting a successful course, however, must encompass new fundamentals of process and organization. These are decidedly unsexy topics, but essential to overcoming the energy inertia of the last few decades. DOE is the most visible change agent. I use that term lightly. So it's worth a few minutes reviewing its organization, energy investments, and priorities. This is the current organization of DOE energy programs. The energy technology programs over here under the Undersecretary for Energy and Environment are lined up around fuels, renewables, fossil, nuclear, with electric liability kind of stuck out there. That's a new office created just within the last 3 or 4 years. The Office of Science reports to the Undersecretary for Science. I understand you all had him up here a few weeks ago. He's terrific. And finally, the ARPA-E program. It's a new program. It was established by law, and the Congress directed that the office report directly to the Secretary. So that is complying with the law. This slide provides a snapshot of the Obama administration's funding priorities for the coming fiscal year. These funding amounts are for R&D only. They exclude things like weatherization and the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, for example. Renewables receives the most funding of the applied energy offices, with the bulk going to solar, then biofuels, biorefineries, then buildings. This makes sense given the state of the technology, so that you would be spending the most money on them. Efficiency is next, with almost half of the money going to vehicles. Nuclear and fossil are relatively close in size. One word about fossil. This is the president's FY11 request. 100% of the fossil budget is for coal. There's nothing for oil. There's nothing for gas, prompting some of us to encourage them to change the office, the name of DOE's Office of Fossil Energy to the Office of Coal. Electricity is very small. And ARPA-E there is at $300 million. This is on top of the $400 million that was included in the stimulus package to kick ARPA-E off. The smallest energy program in the science office for fusion is larger than the request for nuclear, ARPA-E, or electricity. The largest science program request, basic energy sciences, is roughly equal to the combined funding for renewables, efficiency, and fossil, the top three applied programs at the department. I highlight the outsized budget for science for a reason. In a time of scarce resources, I believe that more strategic basic energy research, not only science for its own sake, which has been the history of this office, I believe that that is in order. We also need formal mechanisms to ensure that we can effectively migrate basic science research and results over to technology solutions on the applied side of DOE's house. Turning to DOE's laboratory system, I'd like to make a few points about each of the labs that receive applied energy funds. These numbers do not include science funding, and they also exclude all lines that were less than $5 million at any given lab. First, this is the National Energy Technology Laboratory, or NETL, which reports up through the Office of Fossil Energy. This lab is largely about coal research. All of these funds are for coal except for the geothermal line and some of the electricity that you see there. One other note about NETL. While these research lines look robust, and they certainly will look robust when you look at the other labs, NETL is the only lab in the DOE system that is government-owned and government-operated, and all of its employees are feds. All the other labs in the system are managed by contractors, and the employees there are contract employees. This is important because it makes a huge difference on the research done in-house. NETL does very little in-house research. It's largely passed through, largely to industry. So it is critical that its procurement processes be streamlined and everything that can be done, should be done, in order to accelerate a marketplace deployment of the technologies that they are supporting. Next is Oak Ridge, which has the largest concentration of vehicle technology funding in the DOE complex. Argonne in Illinois has a fairly large amount of nuclear research and is second only to Oak Ridge in vehicle technology funding. NREL is DOE's renewable energy laboratory, reporting up through the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. Solar is its largest concentration, followed by biomass and biorefineries. Sandia is one of DOE's defense labs, but its solar research funding is second only to NREL's in the lab system. Los Alamos is the other defense lab, and not surprisingly, its funding for nuclear research is the second largest in the complex. Lawrence Berkeley, a significant lab in the DOE system, but most of its research funding comes from the DOE Science Office. And finally, Idaho National Laboratory is DOE's nuclear lab, where funding in this area dwarfs all others in the lab. In fact, funding for nuclear at INEL dwarfs all applied research lines at all of the labs. These are aggregated totals for the labs here. As you can see, conventional energy is the winner, with nuclear way out in front at $519 million, and sequestration for coal a very distant second at $133 million. All renewables research lines combined are less than half of that for nuclear. And I note here that the lab funding in these various lines is substantially lower than the total research funding request that you saw in the president's budget request. That's because a lot of the funds are distributed out of headquarters and from their operations offices around the country. I know that this has been a little tedious, talking about each of these labs, but I wanted to clearly illustrate some key points for you. First, overall funding levels for applied energy research at the labs is very low relative to the size of the challenges. Second, the applied programs have adequately funded their lead labs, NETL, NREL, and INEL. But DOE has spread the rest of the research funds pretty broadly and in some instances shallowly across the complex. Finally, it's worth noting that the labs provide the nation with an essential research capabilities and outcomes. They support a highly skilled and valuable workforce and provide large platforms that are suitable for a range of research activities. Historically, however, their engagement of academia and industry, two critical links in the innovation value chain, has been erratic and sometimes underwhelming. Also, the labs have suffered from shifts in administration priorities and a fair amount of political meddling. Finally, let's return to DOE's organizational structure. A relic of the 1970s, the Energy Technology Offices, as I mentioned earlier, are organized around fuels, nuclear, fossil, and renewables, with efficiency inexplicably placed in the renewables office, even though its opportunity targets are largely in the fossil fuel arena. This structure perpetuates a growing energy anachronism. Fuels with discrete end uses, such as oil only for transportation or coal only for power. In fact, and largely enabled by basic science and technology advances, fuels are much more interchangeable and more competitive in their end uses. Coal, gas, and biomass to liquids for transportation, and electric hybrid vehicles fueled by coal-fired or renewable power generation are examples of this growing capability. I believe that this fuel-centric organizational structure has been overtaken by events and is, in fact, inhibiting our ability to transform our energy systems. Let me illustrate these problems by just posing a few questions. In this structure, is there a home to facilitate the migration of basic science discoveries to technology solutions? They operate under different leadership, different undersecretaries, and there are no formal mechanisms for doing this. Again, why is the efficiency office efficiency in the renewables office? Which office is responsible for distributed generation? What is the relationship of electricity to primary fuel sources? How is this relationship managed in this structure? They have this reliability office down below, but electricity is affected and affects all of the fuel sources you see above. Where would you put an energy and water program in this structure? I actually wanted to get some funding for an energy and water program at DOE, and there was no organizational home or program for it. Is there any significant relationship between vehicle, building, and industrial efficiency technologies? There really is none. I can answer that question. Where does transportation fit? What about transportation fuels? What if we electrify the transportation system? If a fuel meets environmental and other standards, do we really care which fuel we use? And most importantly, I think, can we develop a comprehensive research and policy portfolio when offices are organized around fuels? I've toyed with a couple of options to the current structure. First, I would combine the two separate undersecretaries of energy for energy and science into a single position to enhance the integration of the basic and applied research at DOE. This is no reflection on the excellent people who are in these jobs today. They filled available positions. They are doing terrific work. Nevertheless, I think that in the long run, an integrated position makes more sense. For a long time, I had thought that an end-use model focused on transportation, industry, and buildings would make a lot of sense. It would focus on consumers and enable a portfolio approach to DOE research. In the end, however, it still seems to me to be too narrow and, at the same time, too removed from energy fundamentals. Here's why. Innovation in the energy space does not seek to alter essential energy functions. It still simply seeks to supply heat, fuel, and power. No matter what alternative energies we come up with, they are still going to be providing these same functions. This establishes some pretty firm boundary conditions for both innovation and cost. In the end, consumers just want affordable, reliable, and sometimes clean energy. Also, our time-worn measures of a successful energy policy seldom have much to do with energy fundamentals. Instead, energy successes seem to be measured one-off. Is the economy performing well? Is the environment clean enough? Do our sources of energy enhance or reduce national security? I believe that the current organization of DOE buries the concept of function under a mountain of supply, and that an end-use model would lose focus on energy fundamentals. Structuring the programs around key energy functions, fuel, heat, power, makes the most sense to me. I would also explicitly embed efficiency, carbon management, and water into each of these programs and develop formal mechanisms to address cross-cutting issues, which will always exist in energy. It's very complicated and complex, no matter what the structure is. This structure would also prevent the current competition between fuels and likely force a much more meaningful focus on, for example, land use or air quality standards, regardless of the energy source. In closing, let me say that there is enormous public interest in transforming our energy systems. This suggests, indeed requires, a strong federal role to provide a range of technology options for the marketplace. I think that this is the strongest role the federal government has. This is especially critical in the absence of a carbon price. The marketplace currently has little to no incentive to invest in lower carbon alternatives. As the National Academy noted in its 2001 report, DOE energy research is indeed worth it, and it has a history of major successes. That same report noted, however, that these successes are, by and large, serendipitous. The climate change imperative means that we can no longer afford to rely on serendipity to get us where we need to be. The administration is on the right track with its support for an entirely new, appropriately focused energy innovation ecosystem. These efforts, however, while necessary, are insufficient. We also need to restructure the Department of Energy, dramatically increase its funding base, review its contracting and operations practices to ensure that they help, not hinder, the transformation to a cleaner energy future, and vastly improve and depoliticize the government's analytical capabilities to make certain that we don't waste scarce resources on programs that have little or no chance of success. While not a complete list by any means, these changes will make us more capable of making the right policy choices and technology investments to meet the energy needs of the 21st century to help ensure that we are indeed up to the job. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture titled Enabling a Clean Energy Future by Melanie Kenderdine, Executive Director of the MIT Energy Initiative. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University Clean Energy and Environmental Sustainability Initiative. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.